for some reason they just shuffled.
Good afternoon, members. I call this Committee on Human Services Finance to order. Members, please have a seat and we'll get started. We have a quorum present. We'll start with the approval of minutes for March 20th, 2023. Vice Chair Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would be delighted to move the minutes for March 20th, 2023.
Vice Chair Barnes moves the approval for minutes for March 20, 2023. Any discussions? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes for March 20, 2023 are now approved. With that, members, we have a few bills before us this afternoon. The first bill is House File 2568. Professor Finkley, welcome to the committee. We'll move your House File 2568 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members. House File 2568, is an appropriation for fiscal year 24 and 25 of $10 million a year to protect people living with HIV in the state of Minnesota. This is coming on the heels of a decrease in HIV funding from the federal government, that in the money that would be generally received by the Department of Human Services. Is also coming at a time when Minnesota is in an outbreak, an HIV outbreak. Our first ever was declared in 2020, and it continues to this day. So we have a great need for this money. We have had the same funding levels of HIV since the 90s. We have more people than ever living with HIV in the state of Minnesota, and it's crucial that we are doing everything we can to end HIV in Minnesota. And with that, I will pass it to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes. Hi, everyone. My name is Ocean Loon. I am the Community Engagement Coordinator at the Youth and AIDS Projects. I think I'll start today with a saying my boss always says, and she usually says, no young person walks through our door simply because they slept with the wrong person one night. And that is very much my story as well. 18 years ago, when I was 19, I was a homeless kid and a sex worker, and I found out, by taking the only HIV test I ever needed, I found out that I had HIV. And so I decided, because I didn't know much about HIV, to educate myself. And in doing so, I decided to educate others. And so I found myself in a career in public health that I never imagined I would have. But the reason I can sit before you today is because of the social safety net of services that we offer people living with HIV. The decrease that DHS received would greatly affect us, particularly in our ability to do testing, even with the current round of testing dollars that went out. Not everyone got funding, and those of us that didn't get awarded what we thought we would get. It also would affect support services. So folks who are experiencing homelessness, we try to get them shelter and get them housed. It would affect other services like food services, helping people get to and from doctor's appointments. And all of this is important because we know when someone finds out they have HIV, if we can get them into care and treatment, rapidly, quickly, we can get them to what we call an undetectable viral load. So we would lower the amount of virus in their system. And once they reach that, they don't pass HIV on to their partners. And so it's really important to have this funding, to have these safety nets, so people, one, can A, know their status, because the majority of new infections, and when I say majority, I'm talking about 80 to 90% of new infections, happen because people don't know their HIV status. Those people that do know their status do what it takes to reduce reduce the risk of transmitting it to other folks. So if we experience a reduction in the amount of testing that we have, and we experience a reduction in the amount of support services that we can offer, it would impede our progress that we're making. And even despite having multiple outbreaks, so there's one in the Duluth area, and there's two actually here in the Twin Cities. Despite those, we are making progress in other areas of HIV, and I would hate for that progress to not continue to move forward simply because we don't have the resources. So I would hope, and I would invite you all to join me and my fellow advocates that are here in the fight to end HIV in Minnesota. I really feel like we can do it here as a state. We've seen other jurisdictions like cities make a lot of progress, but I feel like as a state we can do it if we have this increase in funding. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ocean Lun, for your testimony and also sharing with us your story, so appreciate that. Do we have anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussions? Mayor Frances Flatty, Representative Flatty.
Thank you, Rep. Lee, for bringing this forward. This is so important. This is just basic access to human health care, period. Mm-hmm. And there's no way that we can't support it. So thank you so much for bringing this forward. I've been following a bill over in the Senate that's been kind of dangling around. So, yeah, let's do this. Thank you.
Leading you, Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Finke. This is an issue that is near and dear to my heart. I am just wondering if you can tell us what is the federal funding that we're losing? How much is that?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair and Representative New Brindley. I believe it's $16 million total dollars. I'm looking over for verification if that's about. I'm getting an about $16 million from the director of Aliveness Project.
Can we just check with we can get it from DHS if they. We'll follow up on that. So.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how does this differ? How would this money differ? Let me ask it this way. First of all, is this a new grant program? The language is really broad, and it's a little unusual for a grant program. So would this be technically a new grant program?
Representative Finke.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Noor and Representative. I'm not sure if it's all new program. I know it's a historic level of investment from the state of Minnesota, but I don't believe it's all a new program. We have invested in the past, and we can phone a friend if we have someone who could answer that program or that question. But
I'm looking around. I don't see the experts from the department who will have guided us. If Mr. Burdick will help us. I think this has been an ongoing program, but.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Matt Burdick with the Department of Human Services, and I apologize, I am filling in. We've got some folks out today who know a lot more about this than I do, but I've got some friends here on the line. And so I believe this is funding existing programming that we already have. As Representative Finke and the advocates have described, this is in part the need is because of the reduction in federal revenue that the state is receiving. And so we're hoping to make up that gap with state funding in this bill to keep the programming alive and meet the growing needs as we're in the midst of this outbreak.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the like I said, the bill language is very unclear. I know that MDH receives prevention grants that deal with testing, intervention, the pre-exposure, prophylaxis. MDH does, but this says that this is going to go to the Commissioner of Human Services. Is that a change? Or because, like I said, right now, I know MDH handles some of this. How is that going to function?
Mr. Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley. We actually administer the federal, what's known as the Ryan White program, and that's what delineates the activities of this, and this is putting more funding to those activities, which is administered by the Department of Human Services.
I can explain that a little better. Go ahead. Oh, yeah. And so what MDH does is they receive federal money from the CDC, which goes into the prevention of HIV. And then DHS gets a separate pool of federal funding from HRSA, which is the Ryan White dollars, which is to support people living with HIV. Here in Minnesota, most states have it in one chamber. We happen to have it separate here in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for that clarification. So I'm trying to understand how all of these moving pieces work together right now. And I guess I would ask, does MA cover any of these things now? Like, does MA cover testing? Do they cover any of the prevention, the prophylaxis, or frankly, any of the drugs that bring down the viral load? Does MA cover that stuff, or Minnesota Care, or private insurance? Or do all of those things currently have to be managed through these programs?
So your insurance and MA will cover. So if you're on MA, you will get coverage to get like your like medical care and your prescription drugs. Like those will be covered. And then for those who have like private insurance, most private insurance will cover HIV-related stuff as it relates to, like, medical care and the drugs as well. And then we have a federal program. Each state has a program called the AIDS Drug Assistance Program. Here in Minnesota, ours is called Program HH. And that program sometimes helps people pay, like, their insurance or pay their copays as it relates to some of the, like, medical care stuff. Where we're getting some of the, like, the cuts is in that support service. Like, so the things that support people getting to the doctor or getting to being able to take their meds or being able to have a place to house their meds, right? And so it's all of the stuff that sort of supports that medical care. So even with the cuts, like, people will still be able to, like, use their insurance to, like, see their doctor and get, you know, their prescriptions and stuff. But with the cuts, all of our community programming, like, some of our community program around housing, around food security, around other things, that's where that's going to go away if we don't get an increase. Some of those services will go away. And if some of those services go away, then it's harder then for clients to access their medical care, not because they don't have a way to via insurance, but just life then becomes the, like, barrier to accessing if they don't have that support.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Noor and Representative New Brindley. And these are important questions, and I'm glad you asked them, and thank you very much for that answer. And I just wanted to add that, you know, this is funding for people living with HIV, but it's also funding for prevention. And it's also, so providing, you know, ending HIV transmission in Minnesota will require providing every step of healthcare that we can. It will also mean helping people into housing, helping people interface with a lot of the communities that struggle in these outbreaks are communities that are not already going to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Nationwide, the rates of HIV for trans women, for example, are astronomically high, 40 to 50%. And it's because that's a community that's not going into the doctor regularly anyway because of biases, because of all kinds of reasons. So there's all of the medical care that we need, but there's all the social work that we need to do to make sure that my community and all the mm-hmm. communities that are dealing with these outbreaks are able to receive their health care.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate you allowing the time to ask these questions. Frankly, this is a very personal issue for me, and I have lost a lot of people to HIV and AIDS. And so I really do, when I say that this is near and dear to me, It really is. My question is then, how does this function outside of other human services supports? Because we have shelter supports, housing supports, food supports. We have all of these things, and so this is sort of like a special carve out for this group, and it's frankly a lot of money in this carve out for this group. So how does this function as it relates to the services we're providing more broadly?
Thank you, Chair and Representative New Brindley. I wouldn't say it's a carve-out. I would say that we have historically underfunded this crisis. We haven't increased our funding for people living with HIV since the mid-90s. This is not, HIV has never gone away. It's only gotten, we have more people now than ever, and we do have other services, and we do have other services that have monies that are set aside for communities that are facing special crises, and that's what this is, and it deserves attention. Rather, it's not a competition. This community needs money. Mm-hmm. This community needs attention, and they're losing money that they've already depended on. So we should be, the first thing I asked the advocates when I got here, because we're giving money and we're losing money, is are we even getting any additional money? We have. I don't think this is nearly enough to face the crisis that we have with the cuts that we're getting. So while I appreciate the recognition that other DHS work is doing, and it's absolutely vital, this work is also absolutely vital.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the question, I think it's important. These dollars are the funds of last resort, and they're designed accordingly. So we exhaust, if someone has Medicaid and other resources, they exhaust those first, and this really does fill the gaps, as Representative Finke and others have articulated here, where we know that, you know, given the nature of this illness and what it does to folks, like, we need to make sure that there's not a gap in people getting the services they need to be successful and to maintain their health and their safety. And so that's designed such that people can use other things, but where there's a gap, if they are not eligible for those other services or they've exhausted those resources, this comes and fills in that gap.
And
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Burdick. That was actually really helpful. So for folks receiving, and frankly, it's a 20% increase over the loss. So it is a significant increase. We're losing 16 million, but getting 20. So it actually is a significant increase in funding. But so you're saying, would Mr. Burdick, would folks, when you say it fills in the gap, does this provide services for folks who would otherwise not be eligible for those other programs? Is it because other programs have exhausted resources, and so then there's this separate pool for this community? How does that work?
Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley, the answer, short answer is yes, all of the above. So you have folks that have exhausted resources under programs that they might be accessing or eligible for, or for other reasons they're not able to access those other support programs. And so this really is intended to, as I said, sort of meet the need wherever the rest of the system is failing. Mm-hmm. And also intended to be individualized to whatever that person's unique needs might be. It's intended to be broad to really make sure that this is supporting someone's health and wellness when they're living with this illness.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Lee New Brindley, and then I know there are several members on the list, so.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have real concerns. This is unique. That we don't really treat other illnesses like this. We don't treat other things like this and do this carve out and do this specialized funding. I have real concerns. I have concerns. Once again, I say this every time, right? We are spending ultimately more money than what we have available, and we need to be judicious, and particularly when we're talking about providing services that we already provide in other ways, I am concerned about the significant increase that we're doing there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you so much for bringing this bill. So there are holes in our system, all over the place, for a variety of things. One of the places that there is a hole is for individuals who are undocumented. So when an undocumented woman has HIV and is pregnant, if she does not get the care that she needs, that baby is born HIV positive. When this program exists and it works, that baby is not. And that wonderful young woman becomes a successful advocate for other people. And I am eternally grateful that people that I love so very much do not have HIV today because this program was there to meet the needs of their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And they are going to be contributing members to our community because they are not sick. And they are not sick because of this program.
Mm-hmm.
And there is nothing in the world that is more important to me than making sure that we take care of everyone. And so I just want to say thank you so much for filling in this gap for these families and for these people. It means so much to me on a personal level. I just thank you.
Representative Carl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I thought we had programs for birthing persons. And we had pregnancy center funding and special grants and et cetera. And if those programs are prejudiced against certain groups, we ought to fix that. But I thought that they were made to go into communities to help anyone that was in a situation, because there's a lot of different situations that a pregnant person might come into that there are support groups or should be better, and I think there are other bills to address that. On here, I'm trying to understand all federal dollars that come in and all other grant programs, are they so siloed that they restrict utilization for programs that are community-based services? I mean, if we've got a half dozen, and it's not uncommon to have a lot of different programs that are servicing needs of communities that overlap, and if we had a better organization and cooperation between those programs, we could more effectively address situations because, frankly, there is there are multiple community-based support services groups around, and we should be looking at making sure that each one of those is broadly servicing their community. And what I don't like to have competition, our group, your group. No, if you got a community and you're supporting that community, you should be supporting the whole community. And I think that's more efficient. Food banks in greater Minnesota, they work and support not only each other, they also, with aggregate purchasing and help with the shipping and distribution, but they work with the volunteer organizations so that they have people, Meals for Wheels and other entities, and they, if someone needs more of this type of food, there's a lot of cooperation that makes it better. And when you have the community geared to working together, it's amazing what can be done. So I understand that, we're going to get this portion, this silo, but when you take down the silos, and community is defined as all of us together, working together, that I think is going to solve so many of these problems. And that is how you understand what your neighbors need and how to help them. So I just, if this went to the Commissioner of Human Services for grants to assist community-based programs with a focus to make sure that we include HIV and AIDS support services. That way, you're tapping into the big picture, but you're making sure that the commissioner looks out for and doesn't miss you. You go, hey, I'm here. And then when they go through and help all the groups, we do a better job. And I think It decreases isolation and stigma when you have that global homogenous community service. So I understand the intent. I'd also offline, if you can give the committee, you said there's an outbreak. If there's historic data with trending and other information, that might help us better, you know, balance. But I think you understand what I'm at.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kwan. I appreciate the vision of the world that you're painting, and I think we all would love to have a system in place where everybody's service, the services that we have, are servicing everyone equally. I wish it wasn't true that we had gaps, as Representative Hicks said, in our system, and I wish it was true that everybody who had access to the support services that DHS does have access them, but we just simply know that's false. We know that people living with HIV since the outbreak of the HIV epidemic in the 80s have not had the same access. We know that people of color, Black, Indigenous folks, have not had the same access to those services. Trans people, we're just getting here, we're just getting started reaching the communities that have been rejecting us, right? The idea that everybody's being looked out for and not missed is just, it's just not reflective. I share your vision of the future, but we're not there. We need to have money for people who need services.
Representative Zelensky.
Okay.
Let's be brief. We've got 2 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I'll be fast. And thank you, Representative Finke. My questions were related to, you indicate there's three unprecedented HIV outbreaks. What are the numbers?
I don't have them in front of me, but over the course since late 2019 through 2021, we don't have 2022's data yet. There's been roughly about 200 new infections in a particular community. And that community is like folks experiencing homelessness and struggling with addiction. It's kind of the combo. And then, so that's, we have one like that in Duluth, one like that here, and then another one for folks who are gained by men who also inject. And so it's the CDC that declares it, and there's no, I can't tell you the formula that they use, but it's when there's a significant increase in a certain population that typically has like smaller numbers. And so we've seen a big increase in those populations.
Final follow-up.
Thank you, Chair Noor. So when you say a big increase, is that number 200, 400 total?
Well, I mean, we're talking about population. Sorry. We're talking about populations that might have had maybe, you know, half a dozen or a dozen infections a year to now having about 200 in the course of, like, a couple of years.
We'll share the data. We'll get the data and we'll share with the
community. Thank you, Chair Noor. And I would just like to add to the point that Human Services policy, we have talked a lot about how poor data collection is for certain communities. That's true in the state of Minnesota as well.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for this opportunity just to ask the question. Just seeing where the funds are allocated, then how would funds be accessed across the state? That's what I'm curious about, because if you talk about certain, you know, groups and areas where there's been an increase, how would the education piece reach greater Minnesota, and how would things happen that way?
Mr. Pett, I think we can follow up with the current information. So I think that's something the experts are not in the room today. So we'll get the data.
So can I just ask really quick,
sure.
Before this is laid over into something bigger, will we have more time to kind of go over this?
Every bill that is in our possession, we'll bring it up and we'll have more conversation.
Okay, cool.
We're just beginning.
So. I'm brand new at this. Thank you.
The last person on the list is Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Representative Finke, for bringing this forward. I think it's important that we realize that right now is that if we don't do anything, there's going to be a reduction in dollars available to help people in this area at a time when we've got unprecedented surpluses. I think that's not appropriate. We've got to make sure that we're at least holding even. So I think we need to keep that in mind. Number two is I know that in the past we've done things specifically for ALS. I know, what was it, last session or the session before, we put dollars in specifically for research. So we have targeted things. I know that in the behavioral health world, we have been looking at targeting dollars to do these kind of things for people who've got mental health issues, whether they've got addiction issues. So I don't see this as being unprecedented. It'd be great if we had the resources that we could take care of all communities wholly. We just don't. And so at this point in time, I want to make sure that we are making sure that we continue to meet the needs that, and these are dollars of last resort. So if they aren't needed, they will come back into the general fund. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. I know part of the program for Ryan White was established by President Bush then.
Mm-hmm.
It has received full bipartisan support, and ongoing support is much needed. With that, your closing remarks. Representative Fink.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and to all the members of the committee. I know we're laying this over, but I just want to reiterate, this is not a controversial bill. This is not something that does not receive bipartisan support. This is good work for people who need the help. We can end new HIV transmission in Minnesota with the tools that we currently have. Mm-hmm. We just aren't doing it because we don't have the resources.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Representative. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. End HIV report is actually available on the MDH website, but we'll get it to all the members. So I renew my motion. House File 2568 be laid over for possible inclusion. The next bill is House File 2876. Chair Becker Finn, welcome to the committee. I will move your file, House File 2876, to be laid over for possible inclusion. Please introduce the bill and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor. And This is a unique bill of all the bills I have ever presented in now my seventh year here. What this bill would do is fund a Native American Elders Coordinator position within the Board of Aging. And the underlying statute for this bill was put into statute by my dad 30 years ago, but it was never funded. And so we are finally here funding this position, hopefully, to take care of our elders, our Native American elders statewide. And so I know that's what it is. It's pretty straightforward. Some of the language is also updated because 30 years ago it was more, we didn't use certain words to describe our communities. And so that's a lot of the updated language is describing Native American elder and tribal government and using more of the standard definitions that we now use. And with that, we'll turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you very much. Yes, thank you, Representative. My name is Stephanie Cleansing, and I'm a member of the Minnesota Board on Aging. I've been on the board now for 6 years. I'm also a tribe member of LCO, which is Lakutere Ojibwe Tribe of Lake Superior Ojibwe in Wisconsin. However, we are one big happy family, so I'm really happy to be here with my relative. I'm also the chair of the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Access Committee, which is the Minnesota Board on Aging's action arm that ensures that all elders in the state are served equally by all programs and services which the board administers. We have been designated by the federal government as the unit on aging, the state's unit on aging, which is the unit, the agency in the state of Minnesota that administers all of the funding that comes down through the Older Americans Act into the state of Minnesota to support programs and services to elders in the state of Minnesota. During the 1994-95 Minnesota legislative session, a bill was introduced to create an Indian elders position within the MBA. Senate and House authors, Representative Karen Clark in the House and Representative Harold Skip Finn in the Senate, said at the time that the bill was in response to inadequate nutrition, poor health, and the lack of transportation and housing facing many in the Native American community. The authors also said during hearings on the bill that cultural differences and lack of information stand as the barriers to Indian communities accessing services, and that this position would help remove those barriers. The bill was passed through both bodies, bipartisan, and signed by Governor Arne Carlson in 1995. Even though the need for the position was clearly stated and accepted and understood at the time that the bill was enacted, the position was never fully instituted as directed by the Minnesota statute. The only MBA staff position created as a result of the new law was called the Indian Elders Desk Person. That position, which still exists today, has neither the authority nor scope of work intended by the authors of the statute. And this can be attributed primarily to the failure of the legislature, the lack of funding. There was no funding appropriated for the position. The only thing it says in the statute is that it will be done, the position will be created, and things will be done as appropriations permit. Fortunately, there was no appropriations ever assigned to the statute over the years that it's been in state law. So as it is, 28 years later, there's been limited inroads having been made in improving the lives of Minnesota Native American elders. There's a lot of lacking that we still have in this state to ensuring that their basic needs of nutrition, health, transportation, and housing are met. For instance, a 2016 Wilder research study showed that large areas of the state's 11 reservations fall into food deserts, and that the average poverty levels among Native American populations in Minnesota, both on reservation and off reservation, are far below average poverty levels in the state. These findings indicate that many Native American elders are still suffering with inadequate basic needs, since it's always those with the least who are most affected by depressed economies. This lack of significant improvement in the lives of Native American elders living in Minnesota can't entirely be attributed to the failure of the legislature to fund one position. What is clear, however, is that the lack of funding for this position prevented what it says in the statute that this position was supposed to be doing, and that is the development of a comprehensive statewide service for serving Native American elders in Minnesota. Never before has that lack of coordination statewide been seen as much as it was during the recent pandemic. When we were responding from the MBA's services and programs standpoint to nutrition needs within the reservations, within the Native American populations during the pandemic, we found it very difficult to get the food where it needed to be because there was no coordinated effort that we could go through to get the funding to the people that needed it. And besides the fact, as I said before, there's widespread food deserts within the reservation lands. So it made it extremely, extremely difficult. However, we did it, and it was only because of our great staff, and none of them are here today. I was going to congratulate them on that. I don't think I've ever done that. But we worked it out. We figured it out, but it took quite a long time to get those nutrition programs going. And we almost lost it because it didn't work until we were up against the deadline for that funding. So we did it. People were fed. But the lack of coordination within the programs serving Indian elders within the state of Minnesota was very much in focus at that time. The MBA has worked over the years to optimize the funds flowing to the tribes from various Older American Act title programs, and these include Title III and Title VI, through education and technical assistance to help the tribes access the funds and implement the programs and the services. This work, however, has to be done on a tribe-by-tribe basis due to the sovereign nation status of each tribe. It is true that if you have seen one tribe, you've seen one tribe. And that's because of the unique design of each tribal government. So it will only be through an intentional effort coordinated closely with leaders of each tribe on a government-to-government basis that we can get to the point of having a coordinated network of service for Native American elders. House File 2876 is to design what legislators knew needed to be done back in 1995 and what is still needed today, to create and fund a position with the MBA that will develop, in partnership with tribal leadership, a statewide government-to-government, culturally appropriate, tribal-based service system for Native American elders. And I urge your support of House File 2876. Miigwech, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Linsing. Anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this? Seeing none, member discussions? Lee New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may, I don't know, maybe Representative Beckerfin, you know the answer. Perhaps nonpartisan staff can help us. But I'm wondering what the funding currently is for the Board of Aging. Do you know that number?
Chair Beckerfin.
Mr. Chair, that's not, I don't know the answer to that question.
I just wanted to make sure. I didn't want to go to the nonpartisan staff, but.
Mr. Chair, Representative Newbring, I cannot tell you exactly. This question comes up about every other year. They are part of the aging and services grants budget line at DHS, but they don't appear separately, and so it has always been challenging to find out what exactly the Board on Aging budget is. We can ask the department.
Ms. Clinton, I don't know if you want to.
Yeah, I could enter into. I've been on the board for 6 years, and we have lots and lots of information coming to us about the budgets, because that's what we do is we pass money through from the Older Americans Act into our service network, which is AAA's Area Agency on Aging. There's 7 of them in the state of Minnesota, and that money goes to them, and then they contract with services in their different areas, and that's where the services are provided through contracts. The Older Americans Act money that comes down to the state of Minnesota, I can't tell you how much that is. I mean, it's in the millions, and it's given to every state. We are the unit on aging for the state of Minnesota, but there's unit on agings in every state. So that funding comes through our administrative money that we are able to use for our programs and our purposes within the Board on Aging is about $800,000 a year. And for that, we use to help support our staff, which is also supported by DHS money. We do some grant, but we also do some administrative development things for the board too. So, we aren't a very wealthy department at all or agency at all. We do well with what we have. I think the thing that we're looking for here that maybe I didn't talk about with the coordinator's position is that the Title III, which is a federal program coming down through Older Americans Act for nutrition for homemakers in health promotion and education, that goes into the entire state to serve elders in the entire state. Part of that, if the reservations are within those areas that are not served by tribal monies, which come down through Title VI, that title money is spent on behalf of the reservations that are there. And some of the reservations have their own, and they can do their own Title III. Title VI is money that comes down through Older Americans Act and goes directly into the tribes. And it's not a great deal of money, but it's enough to be able to fund their needs as far as nutrition services are needed on the reservations. And the issue with being able to coordinate all of that, because we're the ones that have the responsibility for the title programs, is that we need to optimize whatever the tribes can do in administrating the Title III or the Title VI so that the money can come in. And what's happening is that we're kind of on a hit and miss. Some of the tribes can do it, some of the tribes can't do it. And so we do a lot of technical assistance to the different tribes to make sure that we can get as much of that money coming from the feds to serve these populations as we possibly can. So that's what this coordinator position would do also, would be to optimize the amount of money coming in from the federal government to serve the tribes.
Final call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think what I heard in there is that the board probably gets about $800,000. I think that's what I heard, or maybe Mr. Burdick can give a better answer. Because it sounds like there's a ton of pass-through money.
That's exactly true, yes.
Ms. I think we'll have
more
clarity on how much goes to the Board of Aging. So.
We'll, thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope that we will, because I'm afraid that many questions in this committee are answered by saying, we'll find out more later. But I'm really concerned that we're not going to find out more later. It's a little unusual to fund a specific board position when we are doing boards. Typically, we give an appropriation to fund a board, and then it's up to the board to determine how that is funded. So this is a little bit unusual for what we do here. And if we're talking about $800,000, that would be about a 40% increase which is a significant increase. And so I do think it would be important to understand what funding are they getting now, where is that funding going, and frankly, what are the potential benefits? I mean, if we fund an additional $600,000 as the bill is asking for, is that going to bring in additional millions because this position will be able to better access and better devote that time to accessing? I think that that would be really important information to know. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Noor. And I think 28 years of waiting for this position to do what it's supposed to do, if it had been taken care of, then we wouldn't need to be here to do this. You know, if we were following what is already in statute, our elders would already be taken care of. I would urge you to see the question not as what a percentage of whatever allocation this is, but instead look at it as, is $300,000 a fair amount for us to take care of our Native elders throughout the state? Is that something that we're willing to do? And I would urge you to think of it that way in the grand scope of the overall budget of the Human Services Committee.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. I guess I want to make the statement that I'm sure in this moment your dad is very proud of you. We see generational impacts, and one of the things I really appreciate about this bill is something that I brought up in this space and other spaces, that 65 is an age that not a lot of Native American men make it to. And that's caught some people off guard, understanding that. And what I like about this is it's taking into the way of life that we live, that we live in four components of our life, and elders is one of them. And so I really appreciate the cultural component and the language in that, and I appreciate your time and care in bringing this forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin, for bringing the unfinished business before us. This is 28 years overdue. So with that, your closing remarks.
I just want to thank you for the time and attention to this bill, and thank everyone at the Board of Aging and the folks who've been working on this and trying to see this become reality for a really long time. Thank you.
I renew my motion that House File 2876 to be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. The next bill on the list is House File 1664. Representative Norris, welcome back to the committee. So I move that House File 1664 be re-referred to.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and it looks like about to be Chair Bonner. It's great to be back with you for a second day in a row here in the Human Services Finance Committee. I've told the story before that when I was at Youth Prize prior to joining the legislature, a couple years ago, we were building out a new policy agenda, and we did a bunch of different focus groups and listening sessions with young people all across the state of Minnesota. And every single time, the number one issue was mental health. And that, for me, was kind of the big blinking red light that, you know, something was going on here, and we really needed to dig in and make sure that we were addressing those concerns of young people and providing the resources that they needed to get the mental health support that was so evidently needed. And I think House File 1664 is a step in the right direction, and one of the reasons why I'm excited to carry this bill. Since 1970, Headway Emotional Health Services has provided essential emotional health services to children, families, and individuals in the Twin Cities and the surrounding areas. Their mission is to empower people of all ages to live emotionally healthy lives. Headway operates two day treatment programs, one in Hopkins and one in Brooklyn Center, that are focused on middle and high school students whose emotional health issues have resulted in multiple negative life experiences. Those could include things like poor academic performance, high absenteeism, social and emotional isolation, suicidal ideation and attempts, disruptive family relationships, and multiple unsuccessful mental health interventions. Being statutorily required to provide day treatment services 12 months out of the year, Headway is coming to the legislature looking for funding to cover the cost of transportation, student nutrition, and student learning experiences on those non-school days when school districts do not provide funding. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifier, Pat Dale, who can explain a little bit more about Headway's services and the request to the legislature.
Thank you, Representative Norris. Mr. Dale, if you could state your full name and your affiliation for the record and proceed.
Sure. Thank you very much, Chair. My name is Patrick Dale. I'm the CEO of Headway Emotional Health Services, and I come today to give you an explanation of our request. We provide emotional health services throughout the seven-county metro area that is most specifically related to the work that we do in day treatment. Headway's adolescent day treatment program is unique in its emotional health focus. As a result, we are either the best or the only option for students whose emotional health issues are preventing them from succeeding in school. As a result, students from all over the seven-county metro area attend Headway programming. On the days where there is no academic instruction, our large catchment area results in transportation challenges and costs that are far higher than most day treatment providers who are limited to serving students merely from one school district. Looking at our handout, you will see a list of the cities where students reside and where we provide transportation to get students to programming and back home on the days there is no academic instruction. We are requesting $600,000 for the biennium to support the cost of transportation and nutrition for our students on the 53 days there is no academic instruction. 53 days is the minimum number of days. Based on Minnesota statute, there are currently no funding streams to pay for transportation or food service on non-academic instruction days such as summer break. This means Headway must use its own dollars to cover these costs. Current Minnesota statute connects transportation with academic instruction, requiring school districts to cover transportation. As a result, they will not pay on days where there is no academic instruction. Minnesota statute also requires care and treatment services such as day treatment to be offered year-round without regard to educational programming. Our students are beginning to make significant behavioral and academic progress as a result of being in day treatment programming. Non-academic days bring significant disruption for families. Parents are extremely anxious on the days where there is no academic programming because of the transportation and nutritional challenges that result. Providing consistent programming is a key to supporting the progress our students are making so they are able to stay on track to graduate from our program and to successfully return to their home school districts to complete the rest of their K-12 education. Thank you for the attention to this bill. Passing it would be a large step in helping Headway to continue to provide the best level of support to the students and the families who are badly in need of this care. I'm happy to answer any questions or provide any additional information.
Thank you, Mr. Dale. With that, I do not have anyone else on the list, but is there anyone from the public that wishes to testify? All right, seeing none, we'll go to member discussion. Representative Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Norris. My question is, well, and to the testifier, perhaps, what is the source of your additional, of your other funding? What are your other funding sources?
Madam Chair, Representative.
My apologies, Mr. Dale.
It's okay. As an overall agency, we're about a $12 million organization. 90% of that is fee-for-service, meaning it comes from third-party insurance provision. That is the majority provider for day treatment services, unless there is a Medicaid connection for that student. Medicaid is the second provider, and Hennepin County is the only county, but they will pick up services as the least if there's no other funder available. As an organization, we're 90% third-party paid, 10%, well, 9% contract and 1% fundraise. Of that contract revenue, we do have one contract with the state of Minnesota to provide school-based mental health services. That is, I don't know the full amount, but it's less than $1 million, and that's the only state funding that we get in addition to the money that we do, unless it comes through as Medicaid pass-through or something like that.
Thank you. Thank you, Brindley.
Thank you, Manager.
Okay. Any other questions from members? All right. Well, seeing none, Representative Norris, do you have any closing comments?
Just briefly, Chair Bonner. I think, again, supporting mental health for young people is something that has broad bipartisan support. When I talk to voters, when I talk to other members here in the House and in the legislature, and I think Headway has got a great program. This makes sense to support the work that they're doing when they're not getting the reimbursement from the schools, and I would urge the committee to support this proposal.
All right. Thank you, members. And with that, I'm going to renew the motion to re-refer this to the Health Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? All right. The ayes have it. And with that, House File 1664 is re-referred to the Health Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Norris. And
thank you,
Mr. Dale.
Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Next on the agenda, do we have Representative Curran? Hello. Come on down. And we're going to start with House File 1416. As you are not a member of the committee, I will go ahead and move House File 1416 before the committee here. And with that, Representative Curran, will you please go ahead and start your presentation?
Yes, Chair. Thank you. And thank you, committee, for hearing this bill today. excuse me. This bill today is about Integrated Community Supports, or ICS, which is a new service under Minnesota's disability waivers that first became available in 2021. It was introduced as phase one of Waiver Reimagine. Conceptually, it's designed to provide one-to-one training and support to meet a person's assessed needs and goals in skills like community participation, health, safety, and wellness, household management, and adaptive skills. ICS must be provided in unlicensed provider-controlled community settings like apartment buildings in a multi-unit building or out in the community. Before Waiver Reimagined simplified the service menu, other effective service models existed for supported apartment settings, such as Supportive Living Services, or SLS. SLS was available as a daily rate service and contained some framework components like adult foster care, flexible shared and individual hours for awake, sleep, and remote staffing, nursing, and transportation. The ability to utilize these flexible framework components is what has historically allowed supported apartment programs to customize services while still meeting the intermittent support needs of each person in the program. ICS became available for people on the brain injury and CADI waivers in 2021 and for people on the CAC and DD waivers as of January 1st of this year. The transition, though, to ICS is not going smoothly. Some providers have decided not to participate in ICS at all, resulting in service termination for the individuals that they had been supporting. Other providers are still trying to figure out if they can reasonably continue to meet people's identified needs while still remaining fiscally viable, or if ICS will become too much of a financial and operational drain on their resources. For the individuals, the choices they're left with seem to be to change providers or move to a different and perhaps less independent setting, or keep their apartment and their provider and purchase their other services like nursing and transportation on the open market. None of these choices are ideal, and the best solution is to make changes to ICS in statute. House File 1416 modifies the ICS service by giving providers more flexibility in how it's delivered and allowing ICS providers to deliver the same range of supportive services previously allowed under the SLS framework. And from there, I'd like to turn over to my testifiers to further explain the bill.
Thank you, Representative Curran. And my apologies, I think I referred to you as Curran. Apparently my IT work is making me channel Senator Curran on the other side of the house. Don't tell him. But thank you for patience with me. Thank you so much, Mr. Berg, if you want to go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Josh Berg. I am with a nonprofit based here in St. Paul called Accessible Space and a proud member of ARM. Today, I want to thank Representative for supporting House File 1416. and the work that we're doing here. ASI is one of the providers that has made the transition to ICS services in 8 of our communities across the state. Perhaps naive, perhaps ignorant, but I am very still supportive and looking forward to rolling this out to even more communities as we kind of figure things out, kind of iron out some of the details or wrinkles in the process, which, you know, I think we all come to realize that there's going to be, as change happens, there's going to be things that need to be fixed and identified and worked through, and that's precisely what we're trying to do right now. I will also note that we are working with the department to address some questions and some issues, and we have a meeting this Thursday to continue those discussions. So we very much look forward to talking with the department and their team to answer further questions. I know Mr. Bentz from ARM had submitted some written testimony, so I won't go into great detail related to that, but maybe just give a little bit of a perspective on how, as a provider, we're rolling this service out. So as I mentioned, we at ASI have made the transition. We started the transition in August or September of 22 and now have fully transitioned 8 of our apartment settings across the state to the ICS services. So far, you know, we're making progress and we're getting things done. Throughout this process, we've identified some areas where we can look for some improvement or some things to maybe enhance to allow more providers to jump into this to support more folks living in these types of settings. One of the parts of the bill looks to allow multiple providers to provide this service within a building. This is one of the areas that we'll be talking with the department about some of the details, because in certain settings it may not be a viable solution, such as assisted living or others, so we'll work through that. But just wanted to plant the seed of, think of those settings where, like a public housing entity. So ASI, we're the ICS provider in St. Paul Public Housing's Valley High Rise, right next to Regions here. And we currently serve 5 clients out of the 150 or 200 units in that entire building. And we are the designated ICS provider, which now means no other provider can go in there to support the other clients that may need services. In the past, under customized living, we were able to do that, and then other providers were able to come in and complement the services we provided to, you know, the 195 others that may have wanted services. So if there's a way that we can work with the department on specifically some of those maybe larger buildings or complexes, because we really had a good thing going where we were working, and then like Touchstone and others would come in to support clients that they better served and were more appropriately serving than we could. Another component of it is transportation, and ICS, there's a value placed in ICS. It's one of the things I'm most excited about to roll this out, is we can provide services beyond the four walls of the apartments or of the buildings that we're serving folks in now, because there is a community participation, community integration component to ICS that we weren't able to provide before, because we weren't allowed to provide IHS, individualized home supports, in buildings that we had an indirect or direct financial interest in. So now we can support folks outside of their apartments, helping them get to work, doing the grocery shopping, going to medical appointments, things like that, that we previously were not able to do. However, we don't get reimbursed for any transportation related to that. So this is looking at how can we help bring that community component to the service and be able to bill for and properly get reimbursed for that time and that support. I know one of the questions, concerns was or is, you know, we don't want folks to become too dependent on the provider that is providing the ICS services. I guess I look at it as we just want to provide another option. I sit on City Council. I'm on the Metro Cities Board of Directors, and I know just how challenging utilizing Metro Mobility and Metro Transit can be at times, and this would allow for an alternative solution for folks in our settings to access if they chose to, so it wouldn't be anything forced upon anybody. And the last component is nursing, and this is a big one for ASI. We provide a lot of complex care and supervision and monitoring and support for the individuals that we serve. Prior to this, all nursing components were included in the customized living rates that we were providing to folks in our settings, and Now, as we made the transition, we lost all reimbursement related to nursing completely. But none of the healthcare needs or supports are going away. Best practice and just assessed need show that we need to provide these nursing services, which we will continue to do. However, at this point in time, now we're eating about $500,000 a year in nursing costs that we can't get reimbursed for. 80% or so of our folks that we serve are wheelchair bound. We're providing support to our staff to help individuals with G-tubes and J-tubes and suprapubic catheters and all sorts of things. I'm not a nurse. I'm not clinical. I won't pretend to be. We do a lot of healthcare support and training of our staff, and we understand that there is a value to having that component. I'll just make a quick note. You know, both the transportation and the nursing, I'm looking at some potential grants. We were approved for a grant for some nursing services in a lot of our settings, so we know that there's value in that. And then I also have a grant pending right now for transportation, looking to buy 3 wheelchair accessible vans that we'll be able to roll out into some of our settings. And just the reaction that I got from our residents and case managers of like, oh my gosh, can this be available to others outside of ASI, and I think that's exactly what we're looking to do. So I know there's more work to be done, and we're very much aware of that, and we'll work with the department to figure this out, but I very much hope that you guys can support this and as we move forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. And just for clarity, members, I don't know if I mentioned that House File 1416 is being considered to be laid over for possible inclusion, in case I failed to mention that. That being said, I do not have any other testifiers on the list. Do we have anyone from the public that wishes to testify on this bill? All right, seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Curran, for the bill. First of all, thank you for seeking out other funding and grant funding. That's really good to know. And having purchased a wheelchair accessible van, I understand the costs and how difficult that is. My question is, you mentioned this assisted living question with the department and how that might function. I'm wondering, in looking at the bill language in this paragraph, I suppose it would be, well, lines 2.11 to 2.15, it says that the total number of settings does not exceed 25% of the total number of apartment units. And this paragraph includes assisted living and those settings. Does that 25% threshold not cover that issue?
Mr. Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I would defer to the department on their concerns or questions related to that. I previously worked for the department and worked in the section that licenses home care and assisted living. So, and with the transition to 144G and the assisted living language as it stands, it's a licensed building. So the building is now licensed as assisted living, which then brings in that whole framework and regulatory structure and oversight. ICS is a similar model too, where it's licensing the building now. So to have dual licensures may be the concern, and if I'm speaking out of turn, the department can correct me. But that seems to be the issue. The 25% really comes into play, as far as I understand, as we serve folks on CADI and BI and making sure that we're not having any isolating factors or anything like that as far as the HCBS settings rule goes and that whole transition plan. But I think it's less with the 25% when it comes to like the assisted living and even arguably customized living has been an issue for some of my colleagues at ARM as well, where they wanted to provide ICS services in an apartment building but didn't realize that another provider was in there providing customized living services to another unrelated individual that we didn't know or they didn't know about, and they couldn't proceed to get licensed as an ICS provider for that building because there was other conflicting services being provided in the building itself.
Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that clarification. I appreciate that. I would just suggest, Representative Curran, I think this is really important. And we have to continue to be creative about providing services because it is becoming more and more and more difficult to do so. And I feel like this is another good creative solution
to help provide access. And so I would just say, obviously, we want to work well with the department, but I would also say at the end of the day, we are the ones who make laws. And so don't get too wrapped around the axle about not doing exactly the way they want things to be done. Sometimes we see things, too, that should be done differently.
Thank you. Anyone else on the list that would like to speak to this particular bill? All right. Well, seeing none, Representative Curran, do you want to go ahead and give your closing comments?
Yes, Chair. Thank you. And thank you, committee, for the discussion. I really appreciate the support here. And Lead New Brindley, absolutely. Your words echo my thoughts. So while you know, Mr. Berg said that we are in discussion, I absolutely want everybody involved to have the best bill move forward at the end of the day. But my my priority will always be the person receiving the services. And so I understand that sometimes that might conflict with what an agency might believe. But at the end of the day, that's my perspective, and that's what I intend to bring to the table. So I thank you for your comments, and thank you for the committee's time.
Thank you, Representative Curran. And with that, House File 1416 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. All right. And next up, Representative Clardy. Welcome to the table, Representative Clardy. And as you are a member of this committee, would you like to make a motion to move your bill before the committee? And the intent, members, is to lay the bill over.
So moved.
All right. Thank you. With that, House File 1184 is before us.
Great. Thank you so much, Chair, and thanks, committee. This is an important bill, Bill number 1184. And so in this space, we've had a lot of conversations about the importance of peer support. So this specific bill is facing a peer-to-peer support for parents. And parents with special needs and parents with children with different abilities and disabilities. So when a child is diagnosed with special health care needs, it can really be overwhelming and really can take you back. So this process to navigate this whole medical system and community and special ed, it tends to be very confusing. Professionals sometimes try to, you know, jump in and help you, but their lens is way different than a peer, someone else who has a child that has like similar needs. So the power of this bill is to provide exactly that, a parent-to-parent peer support program. And I have some testifiers here, Madam Chair. Okay.
Representative Clardy, I do have Ms. Christensen on the list. You want to go ahead and state your name and your affiliation with the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Maren Christensen-Hofer, and I'm a parent of an autistic child, and I'm also the executive director for a nonprofit organization called the Multicultural Autism Action Network, or MAN, which is the Somali word for mind. And our organization serves families of children with disabilities, primarily in our immigrant communities here in Minnesota. And I just wanted to let you know that when my child was first diagnosed with autism, I was incredibly lucky to have a huge support network of people that were already in my kind of social sphere that were parents of autistic children. And the first thing I did is reach out to them and just ask, you know, what do I need to know? Where do I need to go? How do I need to figure out services and supports for my child? My husband's an attorney, and I worked in healthcare systems for about 20 years, so we brought a lot of privilege to that journey. We kind of joke that we're professional paperwork fillers outers, and you know, we figured if we can't get this figured out, then who can? But despite all that privilege, we really struggled to put it all together and to find a pathway to get the services and supports for our kids. And for us, it is always readily apparent that if you don't bring all those advantages to the table, that struggle can be even more difficult. And that's one of the reasons that I started volunteering for MAN, being really committed to helping families that maybe speak English as a second language at home, or maybe aren't as familiar with how to fill out paperwork, or maybe don't have all the resources to even know about what programs are available to serve their children. I think that work that these peer-to-peer and parent-to-parent networks do is so incredibly important. As Representative Clardy mentioned, you know, we see things from a little bit different lens, and oftentimes we can kind of see where the gaps are and know about programs that might help and support our children. We use these parent-to-parent networks to provide information about social services, to troubleshoot, to, you know, share information about specific providers, and also, you know, to help provide some of that mental health support to other families. A lot of my dearest friendships have grown out of those parent-to-parent support networks. In closing, I'll just mention that we have somewhere between 150,000 and 200,000 children with disabilities living in Minnesota, and there are many wonderful organizations that are providing that kind of support, but we don't even come close to scratching the surface of the work that really needs to be done to support these families. So this grant is so important in bringing more people to the table and expanding that wonderful work that's already being done. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Christensen. I did not have any other testifiers on the list, Representative Clardy, so I will ask that, but it appears we do have some additional testifiers.
We do. And Madam Chair?
Yes. We want to try to keep it to 2 minutes, just because we are running a little bit short on time and we want to make sure we can get out in time. That said, if for the testifiers, if you want to go ahead and state your name and your affiliation for the record, and go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carolyn Allshaus, and I'm the Executive Director of Family Voices of Minnesota, and we are the home to parent-to-parent network that serves families across the state of Minnesota whose children have any type of condition or disability. I brought with us one of our volunteer support parents, and so I might just turn it over to her to share her experience.
All right, and to the testifier. Again, just state your name and your affiliation and go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sarah St. Louis. I am a support parent with Family Voices in Minnesota. I am also on their a director on their board of directors. I started my journey as a parent with a child with disabilities in 2013 when my son was in a car accident with his daycare provider who was not allowed to be transporting him. And she got a used car seat and incorrectly installed it in her vehicle and then wrapped it around a pole. Subsequently, my son acquired a traumatic brain injury, subsequent seizure disorder, cognitive delays, and other physical disabilities. It took me a couple of years of stumbling around by myself to try to figure out what to do, what questions to ask, what therapies that we need, and didn't really know how to form the questions to properly help my child. After a couple of years, I found an ad about Family Voices of Minnesota. So I contacted them, and that's when my journey changed. I took their, they have a very intense program for training support parents. I took that, and since then, I have helped numerous families on the journey, particularly in areas of brain injuries and trauma. The purpose of this group is really to fundamentally help parents and meet them at the beginning of their journey so they don't have to struggle or go through life trying to figure out what supports they need, what do they qualify for, what questions should they even be asking their doctors. And we do this all for free to those parents. And we help them get resources, supports, how to formulate questions, and how to empower them to become advocates for their own children and be able to change the world in which we live in today. In several of them, I have gotten to take the Partners in Policymaking program through our state as well. And so we ask that you help prove this funding, because this funding is something that supports groups that no other area in our state do. And it is solely on volunteers. We are not paid for our work. We're not compensated for our work in any type way. But we help more families than be able to get and access the supports and resources that they need for their children and learn how to do this in education and in the medical field and in the communities that they live. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. St. Louis and Ms. Alshausen. I hope I said that correctly. With that, do we have anyone from the public that has not signed up to testify that would like to speak as well? All right, seeing none, we will move to member discussion. Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Clardy. My question, just some basic questions about where the funding is going. In the original appropriation, I saw that it had to go to a member of Parent to Parent USA. This new bill seems to have slightly different parameters. Will this be going to different organizations? Is it likely to go to the same organizations it went to before?
I'll speak to it, but you certainly can help. It's my understanding that it is a grant program. So in the past, the money's exclusively gone to the Family Voices, right? And it looks like it is that parameters broaden, but I can verify that with you.
Thank you, Representative. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak to that particular item?
Madam Chair.
Lead New Brindley.
Can I just ask that Family Voices, is that one of the only programs that's a member of this very specific organization, Parent to Parent USA?
We are. We are the State Alliance member for Parent to Parent USA. And as a member of that network of Parent to Parent programs, we follow some very specific best practice guidelines for how we implement our Parent to Parent program. That's based on about 35 years of national research. And then we also have that connection with the whole network that's across the country. So when we have families that have a rare condition in which we may not have a trained support parent here in Minnesota, we're able to reach out to this network across the country and look for a parent match with a parent from another state who's been trained and maybe has a child with the same condition.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Alshausen. And I know it can be a little confusing being here at the Capitol, but just a reminder that we do generally go through the chair. All right, Chief New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. That was helpful. And so I guess my question then, Representative Clardy, do you know what the intention would be? Would this be, I mean, it's the same amount of money as before, and so would the intention be that this would likely go to more organizations this time around, used for the same purposes? I assume the purposes are spelled out in the bill language, but it will just be distributed among more organizations. Would that be the intention?
So, Representative Clardy.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative New Brindley. So again, historically, it's gone to this agency. The way the language is written, it is broader than that, but this is the organization that's doing it and has the network right now.
All right. Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Any further discussion? Right. Well, seeing none, Representative Clardy, would you like to make a closing statement?
These connections are essential to the success of families, and one of our testifiers had mentioned a cultural aspect too. And so oftentimes we, with the best intention, can give advice to a different group but not have the cultural relevance to base your advice on. So definitely I'd like you to support this, since there it has been an organization that's been proven its success in the past. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Representative Clardy. And with that, House File 1184 is being laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, we have no further business before the committee. And with that, we are adjourned.